Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So today, this is a little bit of a different and kind of sobering topic. We're talking about suicide and depression and what the future of depression might look like. Hopefully, we're going to kick it in the butt as much as possible. And I actually have my old friend Dave Kirpin, who is the famous best-selling author of Likeable Social Media and a few other books. And he was actually appointed to the role of interim CEO of Uma Health, which is actually kind of cool. It's a direct payment platform that operates outside the hassles of insurance, and it deals with largely mental health and executive coaching appointments. So it was really interesting to talk to Dave. He's a great guy, and he also has a lot to say about the topic of depression and why we need to destigmatize depression. So let's jump into that conversation now. All righty. So thank you so much, Dave, for making the time to talk to me, because it's been a while since we've like actually had a real honest to goodness conversation. You know, I wish it was under happier circumstances, and maybe something good can come of this conversation, because you wrote something that I thought was amazing about destigmatizing depression and not making it like this thing that people have to hide away from talking about, which isn't, you know, the thing that you're necessarily known for, but I love that you're always able to find ways to, like, if you can help people in some way, shape, or form, you're going to do it, even if it's not your core personal brand per se. But tell us a little bit about kind of what you wrote for Inc. and why you're talking about destigmatizing depression now.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me. And second, I think it's a happy circumstance because we are making some positive change in the world, which I'm really proud of and excited about. So obviously, recently we lost two celebrities to suicide, Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain. And so I wrote an article for Inc., for my Inc.com column, about destigmatizing depression and why it's so important to have this mental health conversation. Yeah, it's probably actually the most viral article I've written in about 5 years. It's been shared tens of thousands of times. It's really, really performing very, very well on the site. And to me, that's a wonderful thing because so many people are having the conversation. So a couple to answer the rest of your sort of why question. First and foremost, from a business perspective, I have taken on a third company. So, as you probably mentioned in the intro, I founded Likeable Media with my wife and continue to be the chairman of that company, and started a company called Likeable Local Software. So, both in the social media space, but I recently took over as the CEO of a company I had been advising for the last year called Uma. Uma Health is a mental health and coaching marketplace that connects clients to mental health providers. So I certainly have a business reason to have the conversation and to get people talking about mental health and sort of to I wouldn't say change my personal brand, but I would say evolve my personal brand a bit in terms of what I write about and talk about. And then equally important, I shared my personal story. And it's funny because I've been very vulnerable in many ways about my dad. My dad has a bipolar disorder, and I've written about that several times, including in my second book, sadly, the least read book of mine, Likeable Business. It's my most best reviewed book, but least read book. But that's another for another chat, perhaps. But anyway, I've written a lot and shared a lot about my dad and his chronic bipolar disorder. But I have actually never written about, nor has it been really part of my narrative about his mother until this Inc. article. And as I wrote, his mother committed suicide. She obviously had some mental illness challenges, and she committed suicide on his 18th birthday, right in front of him. And it was a really obviously quite a tragedy, and obviously really impacted him. And you know, between my grandmother and my dad's illness, I've mental health has always been something really important to me. It's just I haven't really gone into the business per se until now. But I was, I felt inspired to write the article. And while you said it's not the happiest of sort of occasions, if you will, I've been delighted with the response on the internet and the response between, you know, friends and family and strangers and thought leaders. It's been really truly remarkable how well people have responded to the article.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you maybe talk a little bit about it, because I want to hear about it kind of like in your own terms, like how, when did you, you know, and then I want to ask you obviously about what you think needs to be done next in order to move the conversation around depression, you know, going forward. But I mean, how did it impact you kind of knowing that this was something that you had going on in your family and that it was something that you might potentially have to overcome or at least acknowledge that, you know, this is something that people around you suffer from? Do you think that you kind of always view depression as a slightly different thing just because of the fact that you were confronted with it?
Well, so for better or for worse, I guess for better, hopefully, I've been blessed with a very pro mental health and pro therapy mindset for pretty much all my life. My mom tells a pretty funny story, I guess. When I was in fifth grade, I think 11 years old, she got a phone call from my guidance counselor at school, and she said, you know, something happened that has never happened in my 25 years of being a guidance counselor. Your son just walked into my office and said, I think I really need some therapy. Can you connect me to a therapist, please? And so that was my first experience with therapy. My aunt had passed away suddenly, and I was feeling kind of upset, and I wanted to deal with it. And I've probably seen 7 or 8 therapists since. The therapist that I saw the longest during and after college, Judy, was just wonderful in impacting me in my life. And she ended up at my wedding, which was pretty cool. And I'm currently seeing a therapist that I found through my site, Uma Health. I think I've always been extremely aware of the challenge that clearly mental illness has hereditary aspects, right? So it's not like because your parents have mental illness, you're automatically going to have it, if you will. But there's tons of data that indicates that there are hereditary aspects of it. So anyone that, I mean, the given the hereditary aspects, if we have people in our families that suffer from mental illness, we absolutely have, or I believe that we have an opportunity to be proactive about taking care of our mental health. The same way that you're proactive about going to the dentist twice a year to take care of your teeth, or you go to your regular doctor once a year to do a checkup. I've always seen mental health pretty much the same way, and made sure that, you know, whenever I'm feeling down about something, or frankly too up about something, I go to see a therapist and talk about it and kind of make sure that that I'm cool and that things are going all right. And, you know, fortunately for me, I have avoided what, you know, one would call, I guess, clinical depression or kind of clinical mental health issues. But of course, like everyone else, I have times where I'm feeling really down, and for me, I've been hyper aware, hypersensitive about the need to kind of take care of that aspect of myself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting as you were talking, you know, it dawned on me, like, people have no problem at all saying, yeah, I go to a trainer, you know, like physically, and nobody is supposed to be able to, there's no shame in that. But it almost seems like, I mean, I've gone to a therapist multiple times in my life. Right now, I'm not. It wouldn't hurt me if I went to one again. But I think that there shouldn't be any shame in that. And I think the interesting thing is the fact that obviously, you know, we happen to lose two people to suicide this week who are, you know, very highly, very well known, you know, like out in the public sector. I mean, I think that one of the challenges, and maybe you know a little bit more about this than I do, especially in your new role, you know, I feel like there's this interesting challenge where people want to talk about depression and especially its links to suicide, but then there's this concern that, you know, if you talk about it, and I know that 13 Reasons Why has been very much, I guess, under attack, where you have this thing out there that is going to inspire lookalikes. How do you talk about something that needs to be talked about without inspiring other people to take a similar action, God forbid?
Right. It's definitely a challenge. And, my call, of course, in the article and of recent has been to destigmatize depression. I also want to destigmatize suicide, right? Because the thing, I'll talk about that in a moment. But to the extent that if we are working to destigmatize depression and mental illness, and to the extent that suicide is the result of a particularly tough battle with depression or mental illness, we typically look upon suicide as something that is, I've seen people say it's very selfish, it's wrong, how dare you, and that's sort of like not good, because that stigmatizes mental illness. At the same time, to your point, we can't normalize or glorify suicide to the point where it becomes a something that people feel sort of overly excited or able to commit. So there is a tension there, but ultimately empathy, and I believe that empathy and compassion and destigmatization is the way to go, versus sort of not talking about it, and not getting it out in the open. And I do think that things like 13 Reasons Why ultimately really help our society, because it gets people talking. And while the downside of all of this is that, yes, celebrity suicides have shown to actually lead to an increase in suicides, ultimately, the more attention we as a society give this, the better off we will become in the long run with respect to making it okay to talk about and seek help when people are struggling. And that's the biggest challenge. The reason people end up committing suicide is that they think that's their only way out, and they're struggling and they don't seek help in other ways. So we simply have to make it okay as a society to seek help when we are feeling sad and when we are feeling like we don't want to live anymore. I mean, that's the bottom line. We have to, we owe it to our children. We owe it to our businesses, as our article indicates, in terms of the business implications of mental health. But most of all, we owe it to our world to make it okay, and more than okay, per my article, to talk about this to the point where people are seeking help when they would otherwise perhaps think about suicide.
Yeah, no, I love it. I think that part of trying to predict the future and figuring out where things lie is to almost separate out what we want to happen versus what we think should happen. And that, to me, is the biggest challenge. Is, do you see that there are any particular technologies or movements or anything that we can look to that is doing something? I mean, it could be a provider or platform I'm not aware of, but just in general, what is out there in the world that is going to destigmatize depression? You know, can technology help us in any way? Or is this just something that has to be entirely human-based, a human-based approach towards, helping one another and letting people essentially come out of the closet with respect to depression? Or is it a combination of the two?
Great question. I think it's a combination of the two, right? The overall technology can absolutely help, but it does need to start from a point of people and people in high places, let's say government leaders, influencers, celebrities, and, you know, at the local level, you know, local influencers, presidents of school boards and superintendents of school systems and leaders in colleges and leaders in high schools and teachers. Those are the people who are going to lead the way in terms of being, you know, what I call mental health positive. And really that's the positive way of saying destigmatize, but, you know, let's become more mental health positive. And then that being said, of course, there are lots of great uses of technology. I mean, I'll just share a few. I just met with the CEO of Pacifica, which is a terrific mental health app. Headspace is probably the leading mental health app. Seven Cups, really interesting mental health app. Talkspace, a really interesting mental health app. And there are and will be increasing ways to use technology to make it easier to get help. Absolutely.
I mean, talk about Uma actually a little bit, because I mean, you're a cool enough guy that you're not pushing what you guys do. But I mean, everything that I've read about what you do is that it's this marketplace that allows people to find services like mental health and executive coaching and whatnot. So I mean, What are you doing? And obviously, what attracted you to this opportunity to kind of take the leadership reins and help Uma get to the next level?
Sure. So I'll tell you kind of the story of how I ended up in this role. For the past year and a half, I'm an advisor for a lot of different companies, a bunch of different companies. And one company that I had been an advisor for the past year and a half is this company called Uma. And Uma, prior to my joining, was a medical marketplace that was aiming to disrupt the insurance business by essentially having people connect directly with doctors of all specialties to book medical appointments online. So I've been advising them, but frankly, they were trying to take on too much too quickly. You know, you've got to start with one niche. And I had a conversation with the founder, a guy by the name of Petty Hendrizada, who's a podiatrist. And I said to him, you know, I might be interested in taking on more of a leadership role, but for me, I'm much, much more passionate about mental health than the rest of kind of what it is that you do. And I would require that we pivot to full on mental health. The other thing that happened almost at the same time was I wanted to see a therapist. You know, my first thought was, you know, let me do what I would always do when I want anything is Google it. So I Googled like looking for a therapist in my zip code, and I ended up being really frustrated. I found a couple, and I played phone tag with one, and she wouldn't tell me her rates. She wouldn't email me. I had to set up a screening appointment, and it was very frustrating. And then another one, I actually set up a appointment through two phone calls, and then somehow they had to call me to confirm. And because I didn't pick up the phone when they called me, because I don't ever pick up the phone. Who picks up the phone these days? The therapist wasn't available when I showed up. I was really bummed out about that. So then I said, well, actually, I'm an advisor to this company, Uma. Let me see if I can find somebody through Uma. And I logged on through the marketplace, and I searched and looked at different reviews, and I found a therapist that looked like she seemed pretty good, and I saw her rates transparently right online, and I ended up using the service that I was an advisor for to book a therapist who I went to and was really good. So I was like, wow, we are really solving a problem that really exists, because I'm a user that just lived through that problem. So that was enough for me to go back to the founder and say, you know what, I'm ready to take on this new challenge. I mean, it's unlike anything I've done, certainly, for a long time, but I guess I consider myself a serial entrepreneur at this point in my life. And I was up for a new challenge. So I took the CEO reins just a month ago now, and have been focused on building out the site in New York City and building a business model. And yeah, to your point about kind of what we do, we're a mental health and executive coaching marketplace. We connect anyone that is interested in bettering their mental health with providers. Right now we're focused exclusively on New York City, but my goal, of course, is to expand by the end of the year to other markets throughout the country. You know, my vision, you know, we're talking about sort of mental illness, but my vision of mental health has always been one that is really totally inclusive. And I mentioned this earlier, but, you know, in the same way that no one thinks twice about going to the dentist twice a year for a checkup, no one thinks twice about going to the doctor once a year for a checkup, it surprises me how few people consider mental health. And my vision, frankly, is that we all can benefit from mental health, whether it's whether we suffer from clinical depression and need a psychotherapist and meds, or we are a leading executive, but you know want to work on focus, better focus, and with a coach. I happen to be a big show of a big fan of the Showtime show Billions. I don't know if you watch Billions, but you know Billions has made mental health and coaching sexy because of one of the main characters, Wendy. And so when I talk to executives now and I say, do you want to see a therapist? They say, no, I don't need to see a therapist. And then I say, well, how would you like to have Wendy by your side? They say, yeah, I'd love Wendy. Sure. Wendy from Billions, I'd take her. So I think that the society is changing and becoming more and more open to this idea of we all can benefit from a mental health provider or a coach. And so that's what I'm really excited about in working with Uma, first in New York City and then hopefully beyond.
So, yeah, I mean, I think going back to the idea of depression and when people really do need help, one thing that I think is really interesting, I've spoken to you and a lot of other people who are helping to provide some great services to make it easier to find help. But how do we solve for the fact that sometimes people need help or could very well benefit from some type of assistance, but, you know, they're just at the point where they're like, you know, what's the point in even looking for that type of help? Does that make sense?
Do you mean what do we do about the people that are sort of that close to suicide already, or you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think even I can just tell you, I know, like for my example, right? There are times where I think I've struggled with depression, and I know that there are times where I might be. It's certainly not suicidal, but at the point where 100% I should be seeing somebody. But sometimes when people do need help is not when they reach out. So, I mean, I think that we're certainly solving for that technology part of it. And I think the destigmatizing depression to encourage people to go when they need help is another major part of it. But what do we do about the fact that there are a lot of people who are probably listening to even this podcast right now who could stand to have a conversation with somebody, but yet they're at the point where they're not looking to have that conversation?
I think that gets to the crux of the destigmatization issue versus the mental health positivity issue. I mean, we have to get to a point where people see mental health providers the same exact way they see dentists and doctors. These are people that we can see at any point in our journey to help us along the way. And there's absolutely no shame in it whatsoever. And by the way, thank you for sharing about your depression. You know, what happens is we all, because of the stigma, people feel uncomfortable sharing and asking for help. But the more we change that, the more we talk about it, the more we, you know, I bought destigmatizedepression.com because I think this is the beginning of a real movement. And the more we talk about this, the easier it will get for everyone out there to say. And by the way, you said there might be somebody listening. There is somebody listening. There's lots of people listening who could benefit because we all could benefit. I mean, dude, if I could go to a therapist every day, hell yeah, I would. The same way if I could go to a trainer to work on my body every day, hell yeah, I would, right? So we have to make it the same exact thing. We have to make it okay to work on our minds the same way it's okay and even encouraged to work on our bodies, right? There's nobody that would have shame in somebody seeing a trainer three times a week. And yet if people want to go to a therapist once a week, they're like, what's wrong? That's simply the wrong mindset. And we simply have to get to a better mindset. And I have to say, I've been, this hasn't, obviously I've been focused on other things the last 12 years in terms of my writing and speaking and work, but I feel so inspired to get that message out there now, to get the message out that it is okay to seek help for our minds, and even a great thing. It's not just okay. It's a great thing. It means that we care. It means that we care about ourselves. We care about our kids. We care about leaving the world, you know, better than we found it. In the same way that, you know, if we're working on our bodies, that means we care about living a long time. It's the same exact thing. And we've got to continue to sing that message loud and clear, until people get it to the point where, to your point, they are okay listening to this and seeking help, no matter where they are in their mental health journey.
Yeah, no, I love it. I think that's a great point. And I, you know, we normally do a little bit of a lightning round towards the beginning that's a little bit more irreverent and off topic. And I feel like it didn't feel right to do it at the start, but maybe we should throw it in now very quick.
Okay, I'm always up for anything.
Yeah. So, okay, where were you when you found out for the first time that you officially became a New York Times bestselling author?
Ooh, fun question. You know, I love questions that have never been asked of me. And since I do so many interviews, I'm pretty sure I was in my office and I got a phone call from my agent. And it is a weird story that sort of relates to mental health and my own issues, because you didn't ask me this, but since it's a great story, I'll share it anyway. I was in my office. I got a phone call from my agent, and and for a moment I was happy. And then, because I really struggle with being happy versus wanting more, I literally called my wife in the next 30 seconds. And I said the following: Carrie, great news. I hit the Times bestseller list. And even better news, I've decided I want to run a marathon. Like, it was literally within 60 seconds of finding out that I hit the New York Times bestseller list that I decided I needed to run a marathon, which, by the way, I did end up completing.
That does sound very much you, actually, you know, like, okay, what's next? What am I going to tackle next? That's so funny. I love it. What year did you go to your first Mets game?
Ooh, another question I've never been asked. Jeremy, you're killing it.
I try.
I love it. I love it. My first Mets game, I was 10 years old, so 1986. Of course, the year that the last year that the Mets won the World Series. So I was both blessed and cursed by becoming a Mets fan in 1986. It was a wonderful, wonderful year, and I enjoyed it very much. And it's been a lot of years of letdown ever since.
Oh my God. That's, I know it's been hard. My brother was born right before they won, though he was born in like the last few days of September 86. So I was like, he was the good luck charm. I always say, yeah, that is a tough, it's a bittersweet kind of, but, there's certainly been ups and downs, and I know you've been faithful to them, which is why actually this is my follow-up. If the Mets got canceled, went out of business, they were totally gone forever, and you had to pick a new team, which team would you root for?
Ooh, good question. Well, it's actually an easy one, because I spent a lot of years in Boston and I worked at Fenway Park. And so I do root for the Sox in the AL. And so I would become a hardcore Red Sox fan.
Yeah.
You'll notice I would never, ever the other New York team. I won't even say their name on your podcast, but
all right, that's totally fair. I knew it would not be the Y word. Okay, so let's see if you remember this. I know the answer to this. When did you and I first meet in real life? Like, where was it?
Oh, I remember that. It was at Gabe Leibowitz's party, correct?
Yes, indeed. And then I forgot that you were the guy who I spoke to. And then I was like, wait, he's written a best-selling book. That's insane. And we're in the same category. Yeah, small world. And you were his tutor. And he had dated the girl who became my best friend.
Nice.
Yeah, small nice world. Let me see what else. Okay, two more book-related questions. What book or what author supplanted your amazing bestseller, Likeable Social Media, as the number one social media book on Amazon for like a whopping 24 hours?
Was it your book? I'm so impressed. I don't know the answer to it.
It was.
I'm
It was, and it cracked me up. It was really funny. It was like 24 hours or so. Maybe it was like 36 hours. And then it went back to yours. And yours had been out for like a while at that point. But that's just a testament. I got to say, for anybody listening to this who has been under a rock and who has not ever read Likeable Social Media, what's amazing is that it's written on foundations that are still very much true, you know, years later. And I think that there's even been other new additions, right?
Yeah, well, now that since you mentioned it, I'm excited. We're working on a third edition. We did a second edition in 2015. So the first one came out in 2011. We did the second edition in 2015, and the third edition will be out next year in 2019. So I did try very hard to make it foundational and really sort of broad based and strategy based, so as not to have to update it all the time. But of course, the way the social media world moves, things do in fact change, and so that's why we're working on a new edition right as we speak.
Nice. And then I think the last lightning round question is: what's your next book about? Obviously, you've got the update, so there's a lot of work that goes into that. But we won't hold you to this if nothing's firm. But what's a topic that you really want to dive into next?
Well, you know, it's funny because I have been working, or rather staring at a blank page for 2 years on a young adult nonfiction book called Normal, which is about four kids growing up in various situations, one of whom is loosely based on my childhood growing up with a mentally ill dad. And I've been kind of blocked on it. And what I'm hoping is that with this new role that I've got with Uma and this new passion I have, that I will get back to writing Normal and finishing that book. There are a number of nonfiction projects in the works, one of which is a book with my wife, who also became a published author this year with her first book, Work It, a book about digital health with families and parenting and digital health. But what I'm most excited about is hopefully cracking back at Normal and cranking that book out.
Awesome. So I'm really excited for that. Whenever that hits, I'm going to be first in line. Well, Dave, thank you so much for making the time. I know you move things around to talk about this very important conversation, the part where we talked about depression, not the Mets, though sometimes those are the same thing. This is an important conversation to happen. So let's hopefully make sure that on both ends, we both try to talk about it and make more and more people out there destigmatize depression. It has to happen.
Yeah. Thank you so much for giving me a chance to talk about this. And I know it's obviously not what you typically talk about in your podcast. And I really do appreciate you giving me some time. And for anyone listening, please feel free to connect with me on social media. I'm one of the easiest people to find online. My name, Dave Kirpin, on every social network that you could imagine. And I look forward to having this conversation with anyone that wants to, whether it's via tweet or via email or even a call if it's something you want to get, really feel passionately about getting involved in this movement. And, we've only really just begun with Uma and with the destigmatized depression movement. So lots and lots of potential for the future here.
Amen to that. Thanks again.
And thanks again, Dave, for making the time to talk to us. We will have a very different topic on the next episode, so I'm very excited for that. Just to make sure that you guys subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever finer podcasts are sold, be sure to rate and review us as always, and keep that feedback coming because it helps us make a better episode each and every time. Really appreciate all the support. And until next time, I am Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.